Well, to start at this part of Focus 580, I have a quick quiz for you. And if you know what the topic is, you just play along. But here you go. I'm thinking of a major American corporation. It is a corporation that, it's estimated, has at some time employed one out of every eight workers in this country. Annually, they hire about 1 million people, and that's more than any other American organization, public or private. This company happens to be the largest owner of retail property in the world. In fact, most of the income comes not from doing what they do, but from collecting rent. This company operates more playgrounds than any other private entity in the United States. It's one of the nation's largest distributors of toys. And here, this one will certainly give it away if you don't know it already. This company is the nation's largest purchaser of beef, pork, and potatoes. We're talking here about McDonald's. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the fast food industry in this country, which certainly is enormous. This year, just to give you another figure, Americans will spend over $110 billion on fast food. That's more than they'll spend on movies, books, magazines, newspapers, videos, and recorded music combined. Not only has the fast food industry changed in very significant ways how we eat and what we eat, but it's also changed the country in many other ways as well. It's had an impact on the landscape, on the economy, and all of this is dealt with in a really very interesting new book that's been out here just a couple of months. The title of the book is Fast Food Nation. The subtitle is The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. Houghton Mifflin is publisher, and the guest this morning, the author, is Eric Schlosser. He's been writing about the fast food industry for quite a long time. Back in 1998, he wrote a two-part article about the industry for Rolling Stone that generated enormous response. In addition to writing for Rolling Stone, he's contributed to The New Yorker. He's been a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly since 1996 and is joining us this morning by telephone. Now, as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line. So if it would be long-distance call for you, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So in case I got that wrong, let me do it again. Locally, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're welcome to call. We just ask people to try and be brief so we can get in as many different folks as possible. Anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Schlosser, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. You know, when you think about the industries that have changed this country, probably people think about things like the automobile industry. They'll think about computers. They'll think about mass communications, things like that. And I don't know if something as simple in a way and seemingly low tech as fast food would come to mind, but I think you convincingly make the argument that this industry has profoundly changed American life in many ways and in ways that maybe we wouldn't think about.
You know, those are very good analogies that you made to these other industries, the automobile industry and computer industry, but fast food you don't think about. And that's one of the incredible things about it. We all go to these restaurants and eat this food, and it looks the same. But one of the revolutionary things about it is the fact that it looks like food we've always been eating, but it's actually a very different thing. And so one of the real challenges about this assignment was to take this commodity that we all take for granted and we all think we know and look at the enormous system that's arisen behind the counter to sell it and distribute it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that people have been eating burgers and shakes and French fries for a long time. You think of that as being a sort of quintessentially American meal.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seems to take advantage of the kind of things that human beings really seem to like. You know, we like fatty foods and we like sweet things, and this wraps them up all in one particular package. But I wonder whether, in fact, as a result of places like McDonald's and Burger King and others, that that our tastes really have changed. That is, what we think of as being good, what we like to eat, what we want to eat, has in fact been shaped by them. And it's not so much that they were jumping on what we already liked, mm-hmm. but they have really changed what it is we like.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, those things that you mentioned are very important ones, fat, sugar, salt. These are things that we instinctively crave. Another thing about fast food that you don't immediately think about is we don't like to chew, and it's very convenient to eat. It's handheld. The hamburger has become such a popular food for little kids because it's very, very easy to eat. But again, looking a little bit behind the surface of things, the hamburger and French fries being the all-American meal is really a post-World War II phenomena. And before World War II, Americans ate more pork than beef. And the fast food industry, and particularly McDonald's, and their marketing efforts helped make the hamburger and fries the all-American meal. So in that sense, they really did change what we eat. They also, again, when you get back to this food, if you got a hamburger in the 50s, it was a very different item from the hamburger that you'd get at a fast food restaurant today. Fast food is incredibly processed food, and everything about it has been carefully analyzed and studied before it ever gets onto the menu. So the level of fat, the level of sugar, the level of salt, these have all been determined through intensive test marketing and focus groups to create the maximum customer loyalty, and it's very different from just whipping up something in the back of your kitchen.
These days, there is a great deal of concern about the fact that Americans are getting heavier. We definitely have a weight problem. It partly has to do with maybe we're consuming more calories than our activity level, but it also does have to do with what we choose to eat. And not only is it a concern for all Americans, but it seems that it's a growing concern even more for children.
Mm-hmm.
And since fast food, really a lot of it is aimed at children, mm-hmm. has it done something to, and are we in danger of setting kids into eating patterns that will stay with them for the rest of their lives and maybe will not be good for their health?
I think it really is a danger. Again, the fast food industry, in terms of its huge dominance over our agriculture and our diet, is a fairly recent phenomenon. I mean, McDonald's has been around since 1948, but it's really only in the last 20, 25 years that these companies have become so huge and so influential on what we eat and how it's made. And one of the things they've done is not just formulate their foods with a very high fat content so that people want them and like them, but they've also greatly increased the portion sizes of these foods. And that combination is a major cause of obesity. And again, this food is heavily, heavily marketed at children. And the taste that kids pick up, you know, they can struggle with and resist later on in life, or they can give into it. But if you look at the last 20 years, as fast food consumption has greatly increased in this country, the obesity rate among American children has doubled in the last 20 years. And in other parts of the world where American fast food chains have gone, in Japan, for example, as fast food consumption doubled, so did the obesity rate among children. It's not the only cause of obesity, but there's no question that the high level of fat and the large portion sizes are affecting America's health.
Yeah, one of the things I was talking about was a colleague, the trend to supersize things, you know, to make for these bigger and bigger portions and bigger servings, and how curious it is that it seems that the incentive for the buyer is that you get a lot more and that you're not paying that much more. And then that also leads to the question, well, what's in it for the restaurant? How is it they can manage to do that? They're giving you a lot more food and they're really not getting that much more in terms of revenue. But I guess that really goes to the question that, or the fact that people probably would be surprised at just how little it costs to produce the food that they sell, and that they're still making out like bandits, even though it might look to you like they're giving you a lot more and you're not paying that much for it.
Yeah, well, you're getting a lot more and you're not paying that much more, so there is a real value in that sense. On the other hand, one of the things I look at in the book is how the huge fast food chains have really accelerated the industrialization and centralization of agriculture in America, and particularly given enormous power to a small number of processing companies. So as a result, the farmers and the growers and the ranchers are getting less and less money for their products and their commodities. Commodity prices have come down so low in this country that these chains can afford to double the size of your French fry order, and they're really only adding a few pennies worth more of potatoes. The cost of these commodities for them are extremely, extremely low. And the most profitable thing for them to do is to persuade you to get a larger soft drink. The soft drinks have by far the highest profit margin of all. And when they increase the size of the soda they're selling you, again, if they increase the cost by 20 cents, but they only add 2 or 3 more cents of sugar syrup to the soda, that's just pure profit. Now, if you look at the typical fast food order of Coke in the 50s was 8 ounces. That was what, when you ordered a Coke at McDonald's, you got 8 ounces. You can't even buy an 8-ounce soda at these fast food joints anymore. A child's size is 12 ounces, and most people are getting large Cokes, which are 32 ounces or even 40 ounces. Again, it's incredibly profitable for them to sell these big Cokes, but the calorie load is huge, and when you walk around and you look at your fellow Americans, and they're looking a lot bigger, here's one of the major reasons why.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the numbers, and at one point it really is amazing where you talk about a medium Coke that sells for $1.29 has about 9 cents worth of syrup. If they bump you up to a large one at $1.49, they're only using another 3 cents worth of syrup, but they're getting 17 cents
mm-hmm.
for that. And
profit.
And that's amazing. And myself, I don't know how people drink that much liquid either.
Well, if you're thirsty, it's sweet, and it tastes good, and especially with sodas, it's remarkable how much you can drink very quickly and really pack on the calories. If you look at the big gulps and if you look at what the convenience stores sell, there are a lot of Americans driving in their cars with just huge, huge containers of soda, and it's a major, major cause of obesity and influence for obesity for children as well.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Eric Schlosser. He is a contributor to, correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, and has been with the Atlantic since 1996. He's also written for The New Yorker and Rolling Stone. If you'd like to read more about the fast food industry, you can look for his book that's just out here, been out for a couple of months. The title is Fast Food Nation, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. And questions are welcome. We have two people here ready to go, and others certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Urbana to start, line number one. Hello.
Hi. You've hit one of my very sensitive subjects that I think about a lot. I have 2 kids in kindergarten who are taking meals from lunches because I can't stand the quality of the food that they're getting at school. As you mentioned, the sweet, the salt, and the fat. And I often try to say to these children, if I'm there for lunch, actually I don't say to the kids, but I often think, this is not really food. These are tastes that you're tempted by, but it's not really food. You know what I mean? It's not healthy for you. It's corn dogs. And it's chicken nuggets, and I just, I had never thought about the aspect of the prices and how the farmers are making out with it, but that certainly is another angle to come at it from. I'm enjoying the talk. Bye
okay.
for now.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, and it's very hard for parents. I've got 2 little kids, and again, I don't come at this as a vegetarian. I've eaten hamburgers all my life, and I've made my share of visits to McDonald's. But in the reporting and the research for the book, that's when I really learned about how this industry works and how it operates. And if a grown man wants to go get a triple cheeseburger and a supersized fries and a supersized Coke, it's a free country. But one of the things that I have a lot of difficulty with is how these companies are just spending billions of dollars marketing to children with toy promotions and Hollywood promotions. And again, the huge consequences that this has for these kids as they eat a lot of this food now and as they grow up and have to struggle with their weight and struggle with the impulse to eat the food.
Mm. The book is full of amazing statistics. Last night as I was reading it, I kept reading them out to my wife. I'm sure annoying her. I said, how about this one? How about this one? But, you know, it is true that a great many Americans eat fast food. For example, every day about a quarter of the entire American population eats fast food. But I wonder, of that, how many of those are children? And is the are the consumers of fast food, are they disproportionately children, or does it sort of even out?
You know, that statistic is actually about a quarter. It may even be higher of the adult population eats fast food every day. With children, I couldn't find an exact number, although there was one marketing publication I found that said that 90% of American children eat at McDonald's at least once a month. And if you look at what's in a Happy Meal, the Happy Meals are very high-fat, high-salt foods. A lot of parents get McNuggets because they think because it's chicken, it's healthier than the burger, but McNuggets have almost twice as much fat as the hamburger. And again, this is food that is being aggressively marketed to kids, and there's no reason why they couldn't sell a healthy Happy Meal. I mean, they could certainly come up with a formulation that just didn't derive so many of its calories and so much of its bulk from fat.
Well, that, you know, I have some callers. I want to get to them, but it just touches off in me. There was a recent article in the New Yorker magazine by Malcolm Gladwell that sounds like you probably saw it, that I thought was pretty interesting, that looked at the fact that fast food is not healthy and that there are things that we know that could be done that could make it more healthy. Maybe it wouldn't be health food, but it would better than it is, and that one of the keys would be that if the fast food companies decided to make the food healthier, you can't tell the patrons because then they won't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
He points to the failure of the McDonald's McLean, and the problem apparently was that people don't go to fast food restaurants for something that's healthy, and if you tell them it is, they won't buy it.
Well, you know, I thought that was a great article, and I think Malcolm Gladwell is a wonderful writer, but I disagree with that one part of the piece, especially when it comes to children. I think that when parents take their kids to a restaurant, that they would buy something that is advertised as being healthy for kids. I think one of the reasons the chains don't do it is because if they make a children's meal that they call healthy, by implication they're saying that the rest of the food isn't healthy. The McLean was a disaster for many reasons, and one of the reasons was that these companies, again, I mean, they spend, just in a given year, they spend $3 billion a year on TV advertising, and they've been spending billions marketing their products for years, and it's very hard for them all of a sudden, like a super tanker, to switch course and suddenly say, okay, well, here's some healthy food, and we're gonna change the tastes of the American public overnight, when in reality this industry has been forming the tastes of the American public for about 30 years now.
Well, let's take some other callers. I will go next to a person in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. This is a wonderful subject. One thing you can't fault fast food restaurants for is keeping their pulse on the American populace needs. And so I have two sort of disparate questions. One has to do with the advent of sort of the convenient health food, and what I'm referring to is McDonald's fruit yogurt parfait and their shake-up salads and that sort of thing. I'm wondering if there's a consumer rationale for that. And then the second question is, I'm wondering if you can discuss how viral and bacterial infestations like mad cow disease is affecting the way fast food restaurants manufacture and process their foods.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, I think the first part is a very interesting point and a good point. You know, I've been criticizing the fast food industry, and I really do believe they have to take more responsibility for their products. But at the same time, people really need to take responsibility for their purchases. And ultimately, these companies will sell tofu burgers, or they'll sell, anything you want them to sell, people really make it known that's what they want to buy. And McDonald's introducing a yogurt parfait, the salads tend to have really high fat in them, but the yogurt parfait doesn't. I think they're really trying to address some of these concerns slowly. They are, and it'll really be up to consumer demand for them to make the bigger changes. In the book, I look at the industrialization of our agriculture and particularly of livestock rearing. And I look in the book at how the needs of the fast food chains for ground beef that tastes everywhere exactly the same has helped to create a centralized, industrialized meatpacking system that can take all kinds of pathogens like E. coli, 0157H7, and just ship them all over the country before anyone even knows that the contamination is in the meat. Now, the fast food chains played a major role in creating this system, but in the last few years they've been working very hard to do testing of the meat to keep these pathogens out of their meat. And the success remains to be seen, but they really have made an effort to do it. In terms of mad cow, it's interesting that McDonald's is introducing a few dozen new menu items on a rotating basis, and most of them don't contain beef. I think they're quite worried about the implications of mad cow, and they're coming up with as many chicken and pork dishes as they can to hedge their bets.
Hmm. Well, let's go to another caller. This would be line number 3 and in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you can't chart a correlation between the demise of breastfeeding and the rise of feeding baby food, because baby food contained a lot of sugar and salt. And I remember that, was it in the 60s when there was a great protest about the content of sugar and salt in baby food? And now that breastfeeding is coming back, one wonders if that will also affect the addiction on the part of children for sweet and salty foods.
Hmm. I really don't know anything about the formula, baby formulas, and how they've changed over the years.
I know at one time they did cut back on the content of Gerber, I remember, was putting sugar in everything, vegetables, everything,
mm-hmm.
and a high degree of salt as well.
Hmm.
And I know there was a big protest, and there was some modifications made, and I don't know how much modification was made or whether all of the baby food companies went along with that.
Hmm.
But it would be interesting to chart over a long period of time, you know, if there is a correlation between when mothers started feeding baby food rather than breastfeeding their children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess we don't, probably on this particular show, we don't have an answer.
No, but it is interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Let's go to line 1 for another Urbana person. Hello.
Hello. There are two trends that I wonder if you'd comment on. One is McDonald's is moving into the school lunch programs, contracting with the schools to provide that service. In fact, they've even done it with a number of the colleges and universities, including the University of Illinois, which now, while we had probably, still have probably the best restaurant system in the country for a university, Maria Ramos has won award after award for her food services. Still, the union has fast food of a much lower quality. And many of the local high schools and grade schools also have McDonald's. Don't the people in charge of these institutions bear some responsibility for the health of their students? The second would be, why don't schools do more to teach nutrition?
Well, I know the first is a point that Mr. Schlosser, you do deal with in your book. So maybe you can say some things about that.
Yeah. There's been a major move by the fast food chains over the last decade to enter the schools nationwide. for two reasons. One, because they think they can make some money selling to kids, and two, because they want to create brand loyalty as much as possible, as early as possible. So even in cases where it's not an extremely profitable venture for them, I'm talking more about elementary schools than I am about colleges, they're willing to do it in various forms in order to get their product before kids and to get the kids wanting the product. The schools themselves bear an enormous responsibility for this. I mean, again, it's a two-sided sword. On the one hand, these companies should be behaving responsibly and not trying to get kids at that early an age to eat food that's unhealthy. But at the same time, you know, they're just a business trying to make money, and it's the schools who really bear the responsibility for letting these companies into school cafeterias. Now, it's also the parents and citizens who bear a great deal of the responsibility. The fact is that education is grossly underfunded in this country. Lots of school districts are in financial straits, and these fast food companies and the soda companies, which is even more unjustifiable, in my opinion, offer money to the school districts. And if the community isn't willing to adequately fund the schools, a lot of administrators are looking at other means for revenue. And the people who are ultimately suffering are the kids. In terms of nutrition in the schools, it's a huge, huge issue that isn't being addressed. But I also might add that physical education isn't being properly taught, and that school budgets, and again I'm talking about elementary and high school, have been so cut in this country that there are many schools that really don't have adequate phys ed programs. And the combination of lacking adequate phys ed facilities and programs and serving fast food in the schools is just a recipe for future health problems for these kids. And the costs of obesity right now in this country are huge. I mean, the fast food industry has revenues of about $110 billion a year, which is gigantic, but the costs the United States of obesity and people being seriously overweight is about twice that high. So we can pay now or we can pay a lot more later, and as a culture, we're choosing to pay now.
Thank you. I could make one comment on that previous caller's question. The baby food manufacturers were adding sugar and salt, not because babies liked it better, but because the parent would taste the food first, and they were appealing to the parent's taste.
Hmm.
I think this is probably still something of an issue.
Hmm.
But it would certainly build the taste for sweet and salt in fast foods. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. I just one other thing that I remember having read in the book that I think is really striking, that says something about how effective corporations like McDonald's have been in marketing the product to children and establishing a connection. Here's another one of those things that I just couldn't believe. A survey of American school children found 96% of them could identify Ronald McDonald. The only fictional character with a higher degree of recognition was Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
It's again sort of stunning just to think about the way that this particular brand and fast foods generally have permeated our popular culture.
Mm-hmm. And you know, in terms of McDonald's and children, it started out relatively innocently enough by providing food that came with a toy for kids and coming up with a clown. And, you know, the playgrounds that they build are a good thing in many communities that aren't building playgrounds anymore. But once this company got huge, it took on a whole other nature. And as this industry has become gigantic, the amount of time and effort and test marketing and studying and very sophisticated advertising techniques that they're aiming at children, and when you take into account the content of the food that they're selling to children, it has all kinds of unfortunate effects. And many other companies now are in other industries are looking at how successful the fast food chains have been at selling things to children and are now using the same sort of marketing techniques.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I should introduce our guest once again. If you've just tuned in, we're talking with Eric Schlosser. He is a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And if you want to read more on the subject, you should look for his recent book. It's titled Fast Food Nation, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. And we have a number of callers, and we'll continue going next to Urbana and line two. Hello.
Concurring with the previous callers, I read an article about how they were saying that in Britain, men prefer beer and fast food to any other kind of food, and they also surveyed people over 50 in Britain, and 75% said that they would not eat a food they don't like merely because it was good for them or better for them to eat. So I'm kind of wondering, as you've kind of indicated previously, you know, we're all quite willing to be led to the slaughter here. And so my question is, and that what I'm really curious about, have big fast food giants like McDonald's really had to pull strings in the political realm much at all? Could you give me a little bit of a history of that? I assume that they probably haven't, but I want to check with you, and I guess I'll have to hang up. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I think the answer to that question is yes, they have.
Absolutely. And I just want to get back to the earlier point about our tastes and the food that we buy, because I think it's an important one. Mm-hmm. If you look at who is affected worst of all by obesity in America right now, it's the poor and the working class who eat an enormous amount of fast food. And if you look at who the people who are affected the least by obesity, it's the wealthy and the upper middle class. And what the wealthy and the upper middle class have is access to information. And on a scale, the more educated you are, the less likely you are to be obese. So I would argue that once people inform themselves and once people realize the consequences of what they're doing, they may still have a hamburger and fries every now and then, or they may still have a milkshake every now and then, but they're not going to eat food in the same way and make the same choices. So again, I may be a deluded optimist, but I think that there is some free will involved here, and that once people are really aware of what they're eating and where it comes from and what the consequences are, they can change their habits somewhat. And that's one of the main reasons I wrote the book. Back to McDonald's. In the book, I talk about the incredibly close relationship between the restaurant industry and the right wing of the Republican Party, and also the meatpacking industry and the right wing of the Republican Party. The restaurant industry right now is the largest private employer of workers in the United States, and they also have more minimum wage workers than any other industry in the United States. So the restaurant industry is one of the biggest foes, probably the biggest opponent of any increase in the minimum wage. And the meatpacking and restaurant industries have also been very vocal in opposing new OSHA worker safety regulations. For example, right now there's a new ergonomics standard that is really crucial to the health and safety of American workers that's being debated in Congress. And the fast food industry, the restaurant industry, the meatpacking industry really don't want these new worker safety rules on the book. And I talk about in the book that this industry is very patriotic on the surface, in the sense of, you know, flying the American flag and wrapping itself in patriotism, but at the same time has benefited from a long list of federal subsidies, multi-billion-dollar over the years, while professing to support the free market.
Let's continue. We'll go next to a caller in Champaign County. This is line number three. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to get back, and you were sort of approaching it when you were talking about the industry, is what's happened to the meat processing industry over the last 20 years or so, or maybe a little bit longer than that. But I think you've made the case that it used to be high paid, fairly well regulated, and it's now mainly, the work is mainly done, I don't know if this is Iowa beef or everybody, but the work is mainly done by transients and some illegal aliens or undocumented workers, I must add. Can you talk about that? I know here in the upper Midwest, we were watching the Hormel strike some years ago. It's when I don't think they actually were involved in supplying fast foods, but they sort of went the way the, quote, industry has gone. Can you elaborate on that?
There is one company called IBP, which is the largest producer of ground beef in the United States, that really revolutionized meatpacking and did it by following, in many respects, a McDonald's model, by fighting against unions, really changing how slaughterhouse work is done to eliminate skilled labor. And really, when you look at meatpacking over the last 20 years, it's an American tragedy, because when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle in 1906, conditions were appalling in the nation's meatpacking plants. And it took decades for things to improve. And by the 1950s, 1960s, things had improved enormously. And as recently as 25 years ago, meatpacking was one of the highest paid industrial jobs in the United States. And if you were a meatpacking worker, it was a tough job. It was a really unpleasant and dangerous job. But it was very high, very well paid. It was like almost like being an auto worker. And you were a member of the middle class, and your kids could enter the plant, or they could go on and have a different job, but it was a stable middle-class job. IBP and the other meatpacking workers, starting really in the mid-70s onward, broke one union after another, imported immigrant labor, mainly from Mexico, and today meatpacking is one of the lowest-paid industrial jobs in the United States. It is the most dangerous job in the United States. And when you go into these plants, you will find that about 80% of the workers are non-English speaking. About a quarter of them in Nebraska, according to the INS, are illegal immigrants. The working conditions are really terrible. And these are lovely people that have come thousands of miles to work in America. And the injuries that they're suffering are horrendous. Now, the fast food chains have played a role because as they got bigger, they wanted a uniform product, and they wanted to deal with big suppliers, not with small regional suppliers. So if you go back again 25 years ago, there were hundreds of small meatpacking plants in this country, and today there are 13 big slaughterhouses that produce most of the beef that we eat. And, you know, we're talking about worker safety. This has had a terrible effect on the communities where these meatpacking plants are located because of the poverty and the transients. You know, the turnover rate at these plants are huge. But having a centralized meatpacking system is also a way to have a centralized distribution of bad pathogens because, you know, if they get into one cattle and you're putting out millions of pounds of ground beef from one plant, it can really be spread far and wide.
That was another point I was going to follow up on, and I don't know if you have more to say, but it just seems like when you have a smaller plant, it just with well-paid workers, you're going to have more attention to detail. And this is, as you say, no blame on the people that are in the system, but it's not conducive to hygiene. And this idea of having, 100, maybe 300 cows ground up in the same bin or something like that, so that if one cow, as you point out, is bad, then it increases the chance of vectors of disease spreading enormously. Well, thanks for your work. It's an unpleasant subject, and right before lunch, too. Thanks a lot.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's interesting to think about the fact that nowadays people are very concerned about what's in their food in certain respects. They're concerned about genetically modified food. They're concerned about additives. They're concerned about pesticides that might be sprayed on vegetables, a lot of those sorts of things. And that's not to say that that isn't something one might want to be concerned about. But foodborne illness is a much more serious problem. And yet that's something that is, I think, just way below the radar screen of most people.
And, you know, most foodborne illnesses are misdiagnosed or never properly diagnosed, and it's often very hard to connect your sickness to what made you sick because, you know, often when you get a bout of food poisoning and you know it's food poisoning, you assume it's what you ate for dinner that night when you're up at 3 in the morning, but it really could have been something you ate a week ago or 4 days ago or 5 days ago, and that's one of the reasons why these things are so difficult to track. But the Center for Disease Control estimates that about 76 million Americans have a bout of food poisoning each year. That's roughly a quarter, or slightly more than a quarter, of the American population. And most of these bouts of food poisoning are never traced to their source. And right now, there's still a lot of bugs, pathogens, that they haven't even identified that can cause food poisoning. Hmm.
Well, we'll keep talking to people in about the 5-6 minutes we have left. We'll go to Kankakee for our next person here, line four. Hello.
Yes, sir. Eric?
Hi.
Yeah, how you doing? Doing a good job. One thing I'd like to point out, we had a neighbor here recently, and this can't be emphasized enough on the line that you're speaking, is 12 years from now, what percent of these kids are going to come up with diabetes?
Huge.
Huge? It's, nobody has an inkling of what that stuff is. It's just unbearable. And when you get into diabetes, you got your head in a ringer.
Yeah, it's one of the things we're starting to see as we see more problems with obesity in adults and kids is we're starting to see more obesity developing earlier in life, the kind that used to be something that, mm-hmm. that we tended to see in older adults, the type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. that was called adult onset. We're starting to see that more and more in children.
A huge increase, and what to me was incredible, and this isn't happening a great deal, but it is happening. Doctors, pediatricians are finding children aged 6 to 11 who are super obese having heart attacks.
Yeah. One more point.
Mm-hmm.
About 18 years ago, we knew truckers out in, well, that traveled out in Kansas and so forth, and they said, you wouldn't believe the meat that this one fast food chain used. He says, it was unbearable. Before we went into some of these towns, we had to wash our trucks out. And believe me, I've not ever been in that one food chain, and you've been talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that can pop up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to be an Oprah Winfrey or...
Well, one point I want to stress is that I don't want people to be afraid of their food. There's a tendency to swing between total denial of what's going on or a kind of a panic. And what I think is really important is that you inform yourself, that you know what you're eating and what your kids are eating, and then you can make your own rational decision about what to do with it. But because of how urbanized we have become and suburbanized, most people are so far removed from any sense of where their food comes from, of how it's made. And they think it just comes, over the counter, wrapped in paper, or it's at the supermarket, vacuum sealed in plastic. And it's really an important purchase when you're buying food. It's more important than a lot of other purchases we do without thinking about it. So at the very least, I'm not trying to get on a soapbox and tell people what to do, other than to know what you're eating and what the consequences are.
We have a couple of minutes here. We want to try to get maybe at least one more, if not more. We'll go here to Iowa, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Mr. Slosser, the flavor enhancers is quite a subject in itself. It reminds me of the tobacco companies and their flavoring techniques,
mm-hmm.
and the way they modulate the ingredients to make it more attractive and,
mm-hmm.
and more tasteful. I was wondering...
an excellent analogy. In the book, I have a section on the flavor industry that manufactures much of the taste of fast food, and they're basically chemical additives that give you a powerful sense of the food, but they're added to the food later. And you're right, the same companies that make the flavor additives for fast food have in the past made flavor ingredients for the tobacco company. They also make flavor ingredients for the pet food industry, and they make the aroma components not just of fine perfumes, but of deodorant soaps and floor waxes, and it all comes from the same specialty chemical plants. I mean, that sounds bizarre and unbelievable, but it's true.
That's amazing. I was wondering if you studied the percentage of beef that these companies use, the imported beef, if you know... the percentage of imported beef compared to American beef?
Well, McDonald's does not use any imported beef because they have a policy of only buying American beef. as a result, they rely a great deal on dairy cattle, spent dairy cattle, which are cattle that are not always in the best shape. But the other chains often do use imported beef. That beef is most likely to come from Australia and New Zealand, and because it's lean and inexpensive, it's ground in with the American beef. The problem with the Australian and New Zealand beef isn't necessarily that it's bad for you, any worse for you than American beef, although, you know, when you get to the globalization of food in this way, especially of livestock, they may have, you know, a new pathogen in New Zealand that we don't have here yet, and at the same time, you know, we may be shipping things to other people that they may not have yet. We really have to think more carefully about how our livestock rearing are globalized. If you look at Europe with a foot and mouth and with mad cow, those are both major warning signs about what happens when you take these animals and you treat them like they're units of production that can just be shipped back and forth without any consequences.
We have used our time, I'm sorry to say. I apologize to a couple of people we can't take, but we've got to leave it at that. If you're interested in reading more on these subjects and more, there's a lot of interesting material in the book. I would suggest you look for it. It's titled Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, by Eric Schlosser. He's correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Mr. Schlosser, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, really.